Good morning, Mr. Gentle.
Good morning, Dennis. How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm sorry, I was kind of thawing out. It's pretty chilly down here today.
Is it? Really? What's the temperature?
About 20-something.
Oh, my goodness. That's pretty cold for Alabama, isn't it?
Well, it gets that way in the wintertime.
Oh, I had no idea.
We have all four seasons.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize you got that cold down there.
Yeah, in fact, we'll have some sleet and snow tonight.
Oh, aren't you lucky?
It won't be much, just a dusty.
Okay.
Yeah, they have that preoccupation. But every now and then they have some. Well, I recall one year, seemed like it was about March, thereabouts, they had 18 inches of snow. And we have ice storms, and that's the worst because it brings down the power lines. But I got a generator, so I don't care. I mean, if it happens, I generate my own power.
Well, that's good. You're self-sufficient.
Exactly. And we've got enough food in the pantry. We could live in here a good while.
I guess you learned something from going through the wartime and all about taking care of yourself.
Oh, yeah. I guess all that adds up. And I was a radio one, and I studied electrical engineering, and I know what you can do, you know.
Right, yeah.
In fact, that bunker at Dutch Harbor, we had a big generator right outside the two radio rooms.
Hey, let me ask you something before we get started, because I just want to make sure it's okay with you. Is it okay if I record our conversation today?
No, that's okay.
Okay, great. Okay, well, we can start talking then. I just didn't want to be taping you without your knowledge.
Well, that's okay.
Okay.
Hey, where are you? Are you in Anchorage?
I am, yes, I'm in Anchorage.
I thought you were.
Yeah. Well,
Can
I get started asking you some questions, a little bit of background?
If you don't do it, I'll wander all around.
No, that's okay. The only thing I wanted to do is maybe just get a little bit of your background so that we make sure that we have a context for your stories and experiences.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so when did you go into military service? Do you remember how old you were and maybe where you were when you joined?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you that. I mean, I can visualize today how it was. I just graduated from high school, West End High School in Birmingham, Alabama. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. My father worked for AT&T, and he was transferred to Birmingham when I was four, so I always considered Birmingham as my hometown. So when I graduated from West End High School, I didn't have enough money to go to college, and I didn't know really what I wanted to study. So I thought, well, I'll join the Navy and maybe learn a vocation at some point in time, decide what I wanted to do, make a career or come out and go to college. So I rode my bicycle about 3 miles to the post office in Birmingham. I went down to the basement and told them I wanted to join the Navy. And they said, okay. So they immediately gave me a test. And then they gave me a physical, and I walked out of there with papers. And I came home, and my mother said no, she would not sign. I thought I was too young. But I had an older brother who was a co-op student at Auburn University, which I ultimately went to myself. And he was studying electrical engineering. And he said, you tell Paul that you'll learn a vocation, and he'll sign. So when he came home from work, I did just that, and he did sign. And so within 2 weeks, I was off to Norfolk. And as I recall, we had to march about 2 or 3 blocks. There were other recruits to the train station, the terminal. And I had the papers for the group for their Pullman and their meals. And I asked them, these guys, some of them older than I am, they're 19, 20 years old. I said, why did you give me these papers? Because you had the highest IQ. So I saw this sailor when we got to the train station, and he was going to Norfolk too. He had just re-enlisted. He had some hash marks, I remember that. And I told him what was happening, and he said, well, I tell you what, I'll help you with this. And so he did. I don't remember much happening, and we got to Portsmouth, Virginia. And at that time, you had to go across to Norfolk on a ferry. And as I recall, there was a petty officer there. I learned that's what he was later. I didn't know what you called him. I'd never really seen many sailors except at a distance. And he had three stripes, but I thought, oh boy, that's a sergeant. And I called him sergeant. It was like an insult. I mean, he said, I'm a boatswain mate, first class. And I said, you better remember that. When you see these crossed anchors, that's boatswain mate. I said, I'll remember. And I did. We went across the ferry, and it's kind of like a nightmare. Everybody strips down, and they shoot you in each shoulder, and shots and all that stuff. And it was August, and it was July and August, June, July, and August. It was pretty hot in Norfolk. I remember that drilling out in that sun. And every Monday, every morning, rather, before breakfast, you had to run. And I remember there was a boxer, Gene Tunney, who had been in the Navy many years before World War One, who was on the back of a Jeep cheering us along. And so we didn't have breakfast till you ran. And I don't know how far we ran, but I know I was tired. And then we would have breakfast and drills tomorrow, and we had races with these big whale boats that had a coxswain, and we had to be on these oars. Now, during the war, they didn't do that stuff. Now, remember, this is June 11th, 1941, when I joined. And you had to do a lot of rigorous training. If you could measure up to the exercises, well, they'd send you home. So we went on with that training, and at the termination of the training, we sat in an auditorium, and they were trying to decide maybe what school you should go to further enhance your ability to help the Navy. So they put out some signals, dot and dashes, and they said, copy this and say whether this is a dot or whether this is a dash. And so obviously I did my right on that. So they sent me to San Diego. It took 7 days to get across there on a troop train. They'd drop you off somewhere, and then an engine come along later and pick you up and take you some more. And so 7 days from the time we left Norfolk, I got to San Diego, and I was in a radio school learning radio and signal flags and using the light, the whole works. And I excelled in that radio. I had a very good score. But the war began while I was in that radio school, December the 7th, early in the morning. Seemed like it maybe 8 or 9 o'clock. I was getting ready to go to Mass. I'm Catholic. And so, sitting on the bunk, and heard the speakers say, evacuate immediately. The Japanese are bombing us. So I didn't know where they were bombing us. And so we went up to the hills, and later on, I took my wife back and showed her where we went. It was more like a mountain. But I was young. By this time, I was 18. I turned 18 July the 16th. So we stayed up there all day. There was a lady who had a kind of Spanish adobe house, and she fed us, and two or three of us, and then they had speakers, trucks come around and tell us to come back to the base, which we did. All the cooking lamps were out, and so they fed you bologna and cheese and issued rifles that had been packed in Cosmolines since World War One. They were English Enfields. They were not even a Springfield rifle, which we drilled with and used to on the range. They were English rifles. So they gave us a couple of bandoliers of ammunition and a gas mask, and we in the Navy, you know, I don't know if they still do this, but we used to wash our clothes ourselves. It was really a luxury if you had a laundry. And so on the wash benches, that we laid the rifles up there and cleaned them all night long. And then the next day, they told us to leave again. And so we did. And we went back to that lady up there because she had good food. And delighted to see us come with rifles. Nobody knew where the Japs were. I mean, they weren't telling us where they were, you know. You just knew they could be anywhere. And so the next night, there was a Marine base training station, sort of adjoining this naval operating base. And so we teamed up with a squad of Marines. It was a good friend of mine, Bill Brown. He prided himself on being a strong lineman in football, and we had these great big walkie-talkies with whip antenna. Take two people, one person carried, the other operated. So I told him, I said, you carry it, and I'll operate it. And so we patrolled the beaches, I don't know, for maybe a week, possibly. I'm trying to think. Now, let's see, December the 7th, and I went home on a surprise leave. I had 10 days. It must have been about a week or two before they really realized, you know, they weren't going to really hit us there. So they needed a space. There were so many volunteers that so they gave us a surprise 10-day leave. Now, some people just hung around down there somewhere, I guess, but I got on a Greyhound bus and went back to Birmingham, Alabama. It took me 4 days and nights to get there. I sleep on the back seat in a station until another bus came along and went that direction. And I got home Christmas Eve, and I called a taxi cab from the bus station out to my house, which is maybe about 3 miles or so. And I think the bill was 90 cents, and I gave him a 10-cent tip. My mother was almost passed out when she opened the front door. And it was a great Christmas, and it was the last time I'd see Birmingham until 1945. And so I went on back, and we just about completed the school, I think, and it was just some formalities. And they promoted me to a petty officer third class. Everybody didn't get promoted, but the ones who were better radio operators were promoted. And I went to San Francisco to the federal building. They had a radio station in the federal building. That is a comm center. Mm-hmm. The transmitters were at Mare Island, some other locations, but they had receiving antennas up on top of that building. They taught me to be a high-speed radio operator, and I was up there when Cavedian Baton fell. I didn't receive the messages, but it was very very mournful, I'm going to say. People were not happy, naturally. And so, let's see. I stayed there. I lived in, this is what's funny. I lived in this little hotel that paid me subsistence. It was called Astor, Hotel Astor. And the elevator was like a birdcage. I remember that. You go up in that elevator, you see all the wires and everything around you. And the room had a transom, and you open it up, get some fresh air, and you'd hear people snoring down the hall. And a wash basin in the room. And you had a common shower and a john. You had to go down the hall. And let's see, I stayed there a while, and then had a new Navy base, air base station, Naval Air Station, Alameda. And so I went over to Alameda, and I was in a comm center, and also I worked in the tower. Not as a person who landed the planes, but they had a comm center underneath that, and we received messages from the planes, and also we communicate with other air stations. We go both places. I was trained to go both places, and also I was trained to be a radio operator in a plane. So also I would take gunnery. We would get shotguns and shoot skeet and trap, whereas then we went to Eureka and we'd fire off the bluffs at sleeves and stuff like that. And so I was trained to do that. And later on, I was trained amphibious. But this was, I was there. This is what's interesting, too. Let me reflect back. You may recall Jimmy Doolittle bombed Tokyo.
Right.
He left from Alameda. I saw him land those planes that day. They were B-25s. And I don't know how many they were, but you never saw the pilots. But I didn't really think about it. I thought, well, they landed these planes because the Hornet was there. They were going to probably ferry them because they were bombers. They were not the type of planes you see curtains and put them up on the deck. And I just figured they were going to ferry them to some location. I really didn't think a lot about it, but exactly that, it was strange to see those big planes. So we later on found out where those planes went. And so let's see now, any other big events there? After a stint there, I'm trying to recall now, I went to Seattle, to Bremerton. There was a Navy base at Bremerton. It was pretty good size. Let me see. I did some more training, amphibious type stuff. Didn't know where I was going. That's it. Left there. I didn't have a paycheck, and so I had to call home and get them to wire me some money. Because somehow or another, the records didn't follow me or something. And all I knew, I got on a train. They took and I went to. Seattle, ultimately by ferry to Bremerton, but didn't know where we were going. And while there, did some menial stuff. Like I recall one thing, this is interesting. They give you different duties. You just did a loaf. And so one of them was to guard prisoners that were in the hospital. And they said, if that prisoner escapes, you're going to have to serve their time. Well, there was this guy there. I think he was a rapist or something. He was bad, and that I was asked to guard. So you sit at the foot of his bed, and so I told him, I remember that. I said, you move towards me and try to get out of here, you're a dead man.
So was this a Navy guy that was in the hospital?
Well, he was. It was something was wrong with him, but he was. He was to be sent to Leavenworth to serve time for rape.
But was he a Navy guy or just a...
Yeah, he was Navy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is at a Navy base, Bremerton.
Oh, okay.
There were some Marines there, too, that did some guard work. Navy and Marines, well, the Marines are in the Navy, so to speak, under the Secretary of Navy. And then also, Marines and Navy personnel sometimes work side by side. And particularly, all the Marine units have hospital corpsmen, and then too they would have radiomen with the Marines. So you'd have radiomen and hospital corpsmen. But at this particular point, there was no mixture between me and the Marines. This was my job, was to guard this guy who was ill, who was ultimately going to go to Leavenworth, which is in Kansas, which was at that time was a big prison for people who were in the service. You know,
right.
And they were a mixture. I don't know much about that, except that guy, he didn't try to leave. And let me think now. What else? Anything else about that place? Oh, I finally kind of got a clue where we're going when they issued me all this foul weather gear, heavy stuff. And I thought, man, I'm kind of going to Alaska. And so I remember telling my mother, I don't know where I'm going, but I got a lot of heavy gear. So she knew during the war where I was, you know. And she didn't know where, but she knew I was in Alaska somewhere. And so ultimately there was a ship, SS Baranoff, which was Alaska Steamship Lines. They had probably, the Navy had, what's the term? It was commandeered it, I guess you might say, or hired it. And so they loaded a bunch of soldiers on there, and I as well, along with other Navy radiomen and some weather people, and we were headed to who knows where. We left there, and now this is, let me think about it. It had to be like April, some latter part of April, somewhere around in there. And we went to Kodiak Island, but they wouldn't let us disembark. And they didn't know where we were going. That's right. Didn't tell us where we were going. And then finally, when we got out of Kodiak, they did. They said that we were going to stand off from Attu, dislodge these soldiers, and there's a group of radio going to go off, and the rest of you will be back up. And so in the meantime, I'm always thinking of ways to get better food. I asked the radio group in the Baranoff, I would like to relieve them in order to get out of where I was. It was boring. And then I printed a little newspaper. It was like anglicized, that's it, and I copied press. They would send press out in English without coded. This is cold, CW, da da da, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
So I was pretty good. I could type pretty good. I'd studied typing it at West End. Not knowing what I would do when I got out of high school, I took a general course, bookkeeping, accounting, and stuff like that. So I was a pretty good typist. Seemed like to me at one time I typed 70 words a minute, and I could copy that press. And so I would take that down to the galley, to the cooks, swap it out for better food. So I was eating high on the hog. I was not one of the groups that was sent ashore. I was a backup. And I continued to work there and relieve those guys. They picked up some injured. As I say injured, there were some wounded and some injured. They were poor guys. They were not equipped really to go ashore with the proper gear. The Navy had better shoes. We had rubber things that seemed like some of them zipped and some of them had like a little thing to snap over. Whereas the Army, a lot of those guys were in leather boots. And they waded ashore in leather boots up there. And it was still snow. I could see the snow over there. And, of course, we were close enough you could hear the battle rage. And anyway, they were bringing them back. And a lot of them had frostbitten hands and feet and lost their toes and fingers and stuff. So they had some doctors on there that were working with them. And we left there and went to ADAC and disembarked in ADAC. I don't know what ever happened to them, but in the meantime, somehow or another, I caught pneumonia. And so I was in a... They had built some Quonset huts, had this Quonset hut hospital, I'm going to use that term. And they had some Navy nurses. And so I remember they were giving me a sulfur drug. And I was sweat, and I woke up. I actually kind of passed out, I guess, because I woke up and this Navy nurse was changing my pajamas. And that's the last female I saw for several years. I'll tell you what I saw the next one. Oh, I did see some entertainers, and I'll tell you about that. They'll come back to me. Let's see. Anyway, they never let you be idle, so I was in a receiving ship. That's the term, to be reassigned. And
did you call it a receiving ship?
No, that's the term they called it.
Okay.
The Navy used terms like that. It was called a receiving ship, although there was no ship. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I see. Okay.
I don't know. There are a lot of nautical terms they use, like go ashore when you're already ashore, but well, that means you're going on liberty, you know. Instead of going on leave in the Army, you say liberty and going on going ashore, you know. So, like for instance, I went ashore and saw all around San Diego. I was always an explorer, same way San Francisco. I knew all the things like the back of my hand. And also, when I was in San Francisco, there was a library across the street, and I would go over there and read all the magazines and papers free. And then also they had a lot of good nightclubs in San Francisco, and we'd go ashore. That's what we called it when we got liberty. Liberty is when the Army would get leave, you know. But we would call it leave when you had more than 3 or 4 days, like 5, 10 days, that's leave. So we used to go to all the nightclubs, and we actually got a schedule of the floor shows, 2 or 3 of us. And I remember we'd only show up at the time of the floor shows, and we'd just stand, and we wouldn't even have to buy a drink. We just stand and watch, you know. And so, but getting back to ADAC, anyway, after I sufficiently recovered, which I don't remember how long that was, but I did damage my lung because I did not come back to recuperate. And later on, it came to haunt me. So, but anyway, after so long, they decided what they planned for me to do was to go to Dutch Harbor. So I flew in a DC-3 as a passenger, of course, to Dutch Harbor. And that strip, I'll always remember that strip, boy. You can either come in from one way or the other way, but you can't come in crosswise because it's cut out of a mountain called Ballyhoo. And on that mountain, there was a shack up there where the so-called, Jack London were called the Wild, is what they said. And I remember flying in there, and it was kind of rough at first. I'm trying to think about that. They had some tents and stuff, and then CBs, that's right, CBs built a barracks, and this barracks still stands because I was out there several years back with the Elder Hostel. The barracks are still standing.
Do you remember where they're at in Dutch Harbor?
Sure, exactly. I can picture it. Put your back to the harbor. Look straight ahead from the Navy Pier. The Army Pier is over there where you see those fishing vessels go out from, you know, that they go up the Barents Sea and fish. I can't think of that program, but...
Right. Oh, yeah. Deadliest Catch.
Deadliest Catch. Every time I look at that Deadliest Catch, I see myself at Dutch Harbor. Well, right there, where their dock is, Ballyhoo Mountain's behind them. Okay? Now, come on down here. You know, have you been to Dutch Harbor?
Yes.
Okay, you know where the airstrip is?
Right.
Well, just put yourself... Come on around the curve. Right there is the big bunker. I was 40 feet underground, and the bunker still stands there.
Okay.
Now, let's see, what was your question again?
I was just wondering where your barracks was.
Oh, okay, the barracks. Okay, coming all around from the airstrip to the center of the harbor there where the bunker is, in between and off back were the barracks. They're about two or three stories tall, and the only big buildings there. They had a beer hall up in front. It had a place with an anchor, I remember that. And then it had a powerhouse, which we had some transmitters in, all over there on that side. The Navy Sea was up there in the harbor. If you went there, you may have seen the signal tower sticking up out of the ground. Do you remember seeing that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you get on a ladder, you go down there, you go about 40 feet. And we had the radio rooms in there, two of them, and right behind the two rooms was a great big diesel generator. And then you went down this winding concrete walkway, so to speak, and they had a ready room down below. The Admiral was down there. It seemed like they had a kitchen and his sleeping quarters. And he could also get out down there. We never saw him unless we went down there, because he would come in and out down below. And that,
That stuff's not there anymore, right? The underground stuff?
Oh, it's still there.
Is it under the brick building?
No, it's under that signal tower.
Oh, okay.
If you come in the harbor, you're on the left is Priest Rock. You ever heard of that?
Right, uh-huh.
God, I know that place so vividly. Anyway, you come on in the harbor, if you ran straight ahead, you'd run into the big bunker.
Okay.
See, the signalman would signal ships coming in the harbor. You follow me?
Gotcha.
All right, up on those mountains, you got Ballyhoo and you got another mountain, that big guns. And I will tell you about that later. So had great, like Guns of Navarone, had big snub-nose emplacements up there, coast artillery. Okay, getting back to on track again, let me think about it. Well, anyway, the Japanese had bombed Dutch Harbor in June, I think it's 3rd or 4th, simultaneous with the Battle of Midway. As a matter of fact, the Navy had broken the Japanese code. Otherwise, that's when they took out to Akiska, and they were hoping to draw the main body of the fleet to the Aleutians while their big body would seize Midway. However, they'd broken the code, and they knew the main body was not going to be bombing Dutch Harbor and taking that to Akiska. They knew the main body was coming towards Midway, so they had a huge battle. But meantime, the Japanese carrier, Ryuka or something, I heard it said one time, but I can't remember it. they ever so many planes came over and they blew up the Navy radio station, which was with your back again to the harbor, was off to the left. But they never rebuilt it because the Seabees built this big bunker. And when I got there, the bunker was there. I'm not sure exactly, but they bombed in 42, see, and I got there in 43. Somewhere in between the two, the Seabees built a bunker, and the barracks was under construction. And so I don't think I've had to stay in a tent or a constant hut very long.
Did you still see evidence of the bombing when you got to Dutch Harbor?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm looking at a little plate where they shot down one of the Japanese planes.
Right.
And I took the plate off the radio and I got in here in my office. That's about the only evidence I saw, but they killed a bunch of soldiers. Their barracks were... excuse me, let me get a little drink of water here. Their barracks were not where we were.
Right. They were over by Margaret Bay, right?
Right. And they had a sub base over there opposite them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A number of them, I don't know, you know, the various branches don't always communicate. And I'm not sure the Navy knew they were going to bomb them either. Nobody told them, I guess, because they killed some Navy radio in that station. And they killed, what I understand, quite a few soldiers who were out that morning had just lined up for roll call.
Right.
So the story goes. I wasn't there. This is what I was told. Well, let me think of that. Okay, let's see. Anything that might be interesting to you? Okay. Oh, yeah. Right. The reason why I know everything's there is I say about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I heard of an elder hostel. You ever heard of elder hostels?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I heard there was one at Dutch Harbor, and I got all excited. And I said, I'm going to show you where I was, because they always heard me talk about it. And so we went up there, and the history teacher found out about me, and he came up with a four-wheel drive, and I took him to all these places, where they had an underground hospital, and where the guns up all the big mountain ballyhoo. They go over, we went out on the other side too, because I went over there and showed that cemetery by the Russian church, and he already was familiar with that. And we went all around and saw some other emplacements. I'm getting over a little bit of a cold.
Oh, would you like to take a little break, or do you want me to call you back later? Or?
No, I think we carry on. Just let me.
Okay.
I catch myself a little bit.
Take your time.
Well, let's see now. That was interesting. He was a nice guy. And one of the things I thought was so amusing, I think he thought, well, you know, this old codger, you know, he's this and that. But what amazed him is when we went to the bunker, you go in the bunker and you wind down, for purposes, because you can't, if they bomb it, you don't just go straight into it. You have to make about a couple of bends. I said, okay, well, here's a switch, light switch over here on the right as you come in. You flash his flashlight over there. Sure enough, it was there. Excuse me, just a minute. I may get a cough drop right here.
Okay.
I could have shown you that bunker. You got to go up there again. Actually, they don't allow people on there because it's an alley-oop to reservation.
Right.
And so I went to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There's a building down there. And told them who I was, and I had been there. They said, well, you go anywhere you want. So then, I don't know, they must have called the history teacher. I don't know how he found me.
The history teacher you must be talking about is Jeff Dickrell.
Is he still there?
Oh, yeah.
I think that was the man.
He,
yeah, I believe that's right. How long has he been there?
Well, I'm not sure, and I think he left for a little while and went to Juneau, but he's back there again because I saw him this past summer, and he does a lot of work with the kids in his history class. He takes them around town and shows them things and has them do research on the war, so I'm sure the information that, that he got from you is very valuable.
You might have two young children. The person I'm thinking of.
Yeah, he does have two kids, yeah.
I think he had two children. They were young then. But trying to break out of that for a minute. I heard from him later on. And also I received a sweatshirt, a big thing that says Dutch Harvest in my closet here in the study. They passed through the States and they went to Disney World. They had a long track of them. For a while, Christmas time, we were sending each other cards, and I lost track of him. I think that's the guy. Really a nice person. And so, I'm trying to think now. They built this huge hotel, despite the where those army barracks were that the Japanese had bombed Grand Illusion.
Right, right.
And so him and I stayed in the Grand Illusion, and classes were held down there. You know, they have such a big packing situation, a cannery, and they had a mess hall down there that, well, that food was outstanding. They would have food from the various parts of the world because their workers were a mixture of various people from various parts of the world. So so I know those places, let's see, none of that stuff was there when I was there during the war. This is later when I went to the Elder Hostel. And get back to that that bunker. Let me think. Well, I was there for 2 years, like I say, in that bunker. Over 2 years. I see June to September. And I was promoted one time, twice. I think I was rated over second class, and I became a first class and had a watch. That's right. And on my watch, two things happened, very important. A troop ship broke in two up in the Bering Sea, and we got an SOS. You know what SOS is?
Help?
Distress, right.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And so when everything would get... very important, I would relieve the operator and take over myself, which I did. And I broke radio silence and put out in plain language what had happened, whereas other ships would come to their aid. There were about, I understand, maybe 10,000 soldiers on there, a big Liberty ship. And they brought both. They didn't lose a soul. They brought both pieces of that ship into Dutch Harbor. And eventually they welded it all together. The ship left there.
Wow. Do you remember the name of that ship?
No, I don't remember it anymore. And so many things happened. I don't remember the name of it. And I don't remember which year was it. Let me think a minute. I think it was in 44. Yes.
Okay.
I think you can find that out.
I'll do some research on that.
I think you can. The Baranoff, with the ship I went up on, was part of the Alaska steamship lines. I think it had plied those waters with passengers prior to the war. So that ship's captain probably knew that inland passage. Oh yeah, that's interesting. We went up the inland passage to, and then cut across to Kodiak. Well, I guess I was 19, and we had to stand deck watchers, too, and look for torpedoes. Now, how the devil's going to see a torpedo, you know? But anyway, they had all these unusual things happening in the water, and I'd never been up there and seen this sort of thing, so I kept visualizing bubbles. And I told my time until I think I see a torpedo, the guy said, get out of here, that's just some minerals in the water or something. I was not much of a stinger. I love the sea, and I've been all cruises all over the world and up all a lot of the rivers and stuff. But in the Navy, I spent most of my time on land. My brother was in the Army in the South Pacific. He landed at Angar and also a lady that later on was in the occupation forces in Japan. Well, he had more sea duty than I did. So we used to laugh about that. Anyway, get back that ship. We brought him in. Then another event. This was like in 45. But just for my birthday, July 16th, 1945, I turned 22. Just between there and August the 1st, somewhere along in there, I was promoted to chief petty officer. Highest enlisted rate, you know. We called chief. You heard of that, chief petty officer?
Yeah.
Okay, I was chief radio man. About at the time that the war was over, well, let me think a minute now. Oh, again, by this time I was in charge of the comm center. The other chief was older chief, but he had ulcers so bad that he had to go. And the commander, there was a Navy commander who was the communications officer, just tapped me on the shoulder and told me, says, "Al, you're now the chief." I said, "Oh, no, not Al, Gentle, they used to call you by your last name. You're now the chief." I said, "Okay." Well, I couldn't get any uniforms up there. They didn't sell any uniforms up there. So some old chief gave me his hat, and it had this old anchor on it that was sort of green looking. You could tell it had been around a while. I loved it. It made it look like I'd been an old-time chief. So, I still got it. Anyway, there was a hospital ship, I think it was called the Comfort, off Okinawa, and got hit by a kamikaze. And we picked up the message again. I sat down because I happened to be there and took over. And again, I came out in plain language, which was not some way to do things, but I wanted to save the people on that ship. And so, again, it worked. And nobody understands who died as a result of that kamikaze attack. That ship did not sink. But anyway,
did you get in any trouble for making that decision to make that radio call and doing it in plain language?
Yeah, probably would have if it hadn't worked. No. Hey, in fact, I guess that's helped make me first class and cheap. they do. They could depend on me. And this is sort of on the side. At that time, you didn't see many black sailors except as they were mess cooks and so forth. But they had a guy brought him up from the States. He was from Arkansas. He was a radioman, third class. And they gave him to me, first black we had, to put on my watch. I was still, at that time, first class and had a watch. And I asked him, I said, "Well, you know, I'm from Alabama. Why'd you choose me? You got these guys from New York or whatever, the other first classes." And he said, "Because you know how to get along with them." Which is true. I remember the guy, he was very smart. He'd gone to college. And if they wanted to integrate somebody in there, they put the right person there. And he belted right in, and we never had any racial remarks or nothing, to my knowledge. Well, they knew I wouldn't tolerate it. My mother brought me up and never used that N-word. We call them colored people. They didn't even call them black those days. Called colored people. Mm-hmm. So they were, I got along with them well. And so that was just another little incident along the way. And so somewhere along about the middle of August, the Japanese, they had the atomic bombs, etc., and they surrendered. And I never was let to go home because they declared me essential. They wouldn't rotate you. If you were declared essential, you didn't rotate. So, but they did say to me, and I was incidentally in the regular Navy. In fact, I had enlisted under a minority enlistment. That is to say, if you're 17, you have a minority enlisted, and when you're 20, the day before you're 21, your discharge. Well, the day before I saw the one, I was in the Aleutians, and had I just fallen into place, I'd have been put in the reserves. But I could make some money by shipping over a nickel a mile, I think, from Seattle to Birmingham, and something $50 a year or something. It was some amount of money, and it looked like, so I extended for 2 years. It looked like the war was going to last 2 more years. But this was 1944. Well, I didn't miss it far. So, let me think here. Anyway, that's the reason why I was there so long. They declared me essential. And instead I could choose my assignment. And I said, okay, I want more education. And so I said, I'd like to go to a radio technician school. A technician would be one that would repair the sets and so forth. And an operator doesn't do any repair. He might do minor stuff, but particularly if he's on a... Well, let's say I left out an important event. Christmas of 1944, I spent Christmas on an island called Unalga, U-N-A-L-G-A, with 7 men as a weather station, because we had had bombers coming across from, I guess, El Mador and other bases, and they needed to know the weather across the Aleutians, and so we had just the 7. I think I may be one of the 7. Let me see. I had 4 radiomen. I had a weatherman. I had a hospital corpsman and a cook. So we spent Christmas, the 44, there. It was a white Christmas. It was in the Barents Sea, north of Unalaska. You know, Unalaska is that island where Dutch Harbor is?
Right, right.
And I had heard, too, that at the time they were bombing Dutch Harbor, there was an air base on the next island over, Umnak, Unimak, something like that. And those guys came across, and they surprised the Japanese. And it could have been worse, is what I've been told. But get back to Unalga Island, that was kind of a lonesome stay. I think I was out there about a month. They would rotate you. They went to rotated people. They didn't leave you out there. I might have been more than a month. It wasn't long. But the whole duty up there, I thank God I didn't get sent to someplace where I might have got killed. It was just boring and mundane, and the weather was not good. Had a lot of fog in the summer because of the Japanese current and meeting the cold air from the Arctic. And in the winter, there was a lot of snow, but not to the degree on that mainland, and it was cold. And as I may have mentioned to you the other day, somebody said, well, what temperature was it? I had no idea.
Just cold, right?
It's cold. It's miserable. What you would do is, they had this great big recon car, bigger than a Jeep, and the CBs had built a body on it. And you looked outside to see how bad it would be to drive to the radio shack, because you drove from that barracks up that hill to where we went into the radio room. And that's the main thing I was concerned about. How bad would it be trying to make that drive? And that was another funny incident. I never had driven. This thing had a double clutch. You know what that is?
No.
Okay, well, you had shift gears. You didn't have automatic transmission. And so in order to shift gears on that, it was like a truck. You had a double clutch that you pushed in the clutch twice. You pushed it in once, push it again, and shift. So I had to drive it one time. I had the guys all loaded up in there, and I don't know. I didn't want to tell this. It's my first time. So I think I ground the gears a little bit, but we made it. But we would go up and down that hill in that recon car. That was the only thing I would worry about. The summer, it would get, they had a lot of flowers on the tundra. It was kind of pretty. And it would get pretty warm about August. And we would hike up that valley mountain a lot. You had to find something to do. The biggest thing was it was boring. It was just, there was no TV. And I read the same books over and over. That was biggest thing. It was boring, very boring.
Did the Navy have any kind of recreational stuff for you?
Well, they had a gym over there. We would go over there and flick the basketball around some and checked out some fishing equipment, and we went fishing. I'm trying to think, what did they have available? Oh, they had some skis. That's a funny thing. I never had skis in my life. But these guys from the north, a lot of them knew how to ski, said, my gosh, if he can do it, I can too. So there was a couple of southern boys, myself, went up there with a set of skis. Mount McCutcheon, is that another mountain over there?
Yes.
Somewhere along there, there was some kind of ski slope they made out of. Well, boy, I'm telling you, the biggest mess with skis are going every which way. That was the only time I ever did that. But we did have this, too. I saw Bob Hope and Olivia de Havilland. They came through there entertaining us. Joe Lewis, who was a boxer. These are the ones I remember most. Olivia de Havilland ate in the mess hall with us, and she sat right across the table from me. And she was a petite, small woman. Had nice smelling perfume, I remember that. Bob Hope, I didn't get close enough to him, but later on, years ago, I used to have to, on my job, I retired from a staff of Southern Bell. Where I would fly to meet other companies. Bell System, it was called. AT&T owned 20-something companies, rather. And we would exchange information, so I would fly a good bit to other locations. So I was flying one day, and he was sitting across the aisle from me, Bob Hope. And I mentioned him, you know, I had seen you in the Aleutians. He said, you're right. And you know what? He named the month and date and year.
Really?
He amazed me. I didn't know when it was. But he said, yes, well, I remember it was so-and-so and so-and-so.
He had a good memory.
He did.
That must have been quite a thrill to see Bob Hope and Olivia de Havilland at such a young age.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was. I mean, and I don't remember what she did to perform. Bob Hope, he got up there on the stage of this gymnasium. They had a stage in there. CB's built this gymnasium where you could play basketball and stuff. But, you know, I was saying these eight-hour watches, and I would be so tired from sitting around there that I would go and sleep. Now, what's this? The movies, they had movies, and you would walk around to the different locations of CB's. CB's, they had a really good living arrangement. Their food was good. They used to have, I remember this, peanut butter on the table and stuff like that. The Navy didn't have that. These guys were all older, you know, the CB's.
Mm-hmm.
And they had older cooks. And their tables would look like a boardhouse table. They'd have a mustard and all that kind of stuff on the table. And they would have movies. And I'm trying to think. I don't think I ever went to any Army movies. I don't know that I did. Just the CBs and the theater. Was right there in that cluster of buildings. But what you're thinking about, that powerhouse, that's a concrete building. That was the powerhouse where it generated the power.
Right.
I would imagine that's still standing.
It is, yeah. They still use it as a powerhouse.
Yeah. Well, we had transmitters in there. As well as, of course, our power. But if the power failed, we had our own generator. Because you would have to have that, see, to keep operating. Let's see. Then when I left, in September, I got extended leave. That is to say, travel time and then 30-day leave, yeah. And I really was so glad to get home. Well, I got to Seattle. That's interesting. Funny. Flew across to, they said to me, okay, now, I said, I want to go home. And they said, well, okay, you pick out where you want to go. And I told them I wanted to study to be a radio technician. Then they came up with the River Rouge plant in Detroit, Michigan. That's a Ford Motor Company. They had a fleet pre-radio material school. In other words, guys who've been in the fleet may not be able to compete with young men right out of high school. So we had to study electricity and had to go through some math and all that good stuff. But before I went there, I got that leave and came home. When I got to Seattle, all I had to show I was a chief was that hat. So they had to buy uniforms. See, they don't issue uniforms to chiefs and officers. You have to buy them, you know.
Oh.
But they give you a clothing allowance. And you get some other allowances as chief. When you make chief, well, you eat better. I was in a room with another chief, whereas before I was in like a dormitory, you know, barracks. And so I had clothing allowance. And so I went ashore. Now, actually, so you use that term, even though I wasn't on a ship. When you leave the base, you went ashore. So we went ashore and went down to where they tailor-made them. And the guy was going to make my uniform. Well, I was so happy to be there, I never got around to getting it checked out. I was in jeans, I would call them dungarees, and that cap. Man, I was eating high and all. I wanted milk and everything else. So I came back and I said, I tell you what, I just didn't have time. What do you mean you didn't have time? I said, I'm going to have to go out again tomorrow, because they said, well, what about the uniforms? Well, anyway, went and arranged to have them made. It seemed like it didn't take him long, a day or two, and I was back and put the uniforms on. I think I got some dress blues and grays and some khaki colored ones. Three sets. I didn't get any whites. I got a top coat. I had to get a top coat. Got a new hat, and with a white cover and a navy cover. Arranged for all that. And then I think I left and went home. I had not drawn a paycheck, I think, the whole time I was over there, because they gave you soap and stuff, and if I did, it was a small amount, because I didn't spend much money and I didn't gamble. So I had plenty of money. So I decided I'm not going to sit up all the way to Birmingham. I'm going to get a Pullman. So that's easier said than done. So I went to the train's ticket office, and it was near lunchtime. There was some women in there, and they were about to break for lunch, and I said, well, I'll take you all to lunch. There were three of them. I'll take you all to lunch. Be on me. Okay. So then we got back. I said, could you get me a Pullman? I said, I'm traveling under orders. Oh, you're traveling under orders? Which I was. I said, yeah. So they got me a Pullman. And I didn't have to sit up all the way. And it took a while to get back. I mean, that's pretty good. Had to go to Chicago, and Chicago down to Nashville, and Nashville to Birmingham, something like that. But I stayed on the same train, I think. I believe I did. No, I'm sure. I could not have. I must have changed in Chicago. Yeah. Anyway, having left there, I went up to the River Rouge plant, and I was there for a while to finish the course that we had to do, which included building a super heterodyne radio set from scratch. They give you a schematic, and you'd go cut out the place for the tubes in the sheet metal shop, and you go to the storeroom and get the resistors and capacitors and all that good stuff, and then you had to assemble it. And it had to work. So that was one of the requirements to get out of there. So I don't recall having a big problem with that. And later on, it came to good use, because when I studied radio in Auburn, I had to do the same thing, except it was easier at Auburn, because they used what's called a Heath kit, and everything was in there to do it, and all you had to do was follow directions. So anyway, I went on over to Great Lakes. And these were all fleet guys and Marines too, Marine masters, sergeants, and it seemed like we all were high rates, chiefs and Marine master sergeants. And I got ill because of that lung, that pneumonia had done something to me. But most people I went to the hospital, and I remember I was spitting up blood. And so they said, oh my goodness, you know, you might have TB. So they put me on a hospital train to go to Sampson, New York, the Finger Lakes. You ever heard of the Finger Lakes?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful area. Anyway, what's so funny to me is they put me in one of these wire basket-like things and carried me through the main terminal in Chicago, and people were looking at me, so I took the covers and put it over my head. I was embarrassed. And they put me on this train that was like racks. They would hang you down here and put another guy above you, maybe three high or something. And then I got to Geneva. That was the nearest town. And they had this gray ambulance with a red cross on the side. It looked like the same ones the Army used, except there's an olive drab. And the guys are pretty rough. They threw me in there, so to speak. They said, get up and walk and get in there. So I did. And they put my sea bag in there. And they drove me to the hospital, and I was bedridden for, gosh, about 6 months, I guess. It was a long time. And I did have some lesions up there, but they couldn't find the bug. I don't think they ever did, but they wanted those lesions to close before they would release me. But in the meantime, I got to leave because my brother Ed had come back from Japan, and he'd fallen in love, and was getting married, and I was going to be his best man, so... I got to leave, and I went back to Alabama to be his best man. Then came back. About, seemed like maybe a week or so later, they were going to have a honeymoon up in Niagara Falls, and they were going to come by and get me and take me on the honeymoon with them. I asked for leave. They said, no, you can't have it. And I thought, well, I'm going anyway. So I used pillows and stuffed the bed, and told the guys, I'm going to be back. I'll be back in a couple of days. I said, but I'm not missing out with my brother and his wife. I said, I hadn't seen him in a long time, and we were close friends. And I liked his wife, too. And they're both living today. He's 92, and she's a week younger than me. So we went to Niagara Falls and came back, and they didn't do a dang thing to me.
Really? So they did. They must have found out that you were gone.
They did. Oh yeah. And the guy told me, said he's gone. He's gonna be back. He'll be back in a couple of days. He told me to tell you all that. But he said he was gone. I don't remember what all they said to him. But they told him. And let's see now what happened there. I stayed there a while, and finally I got released to be under a doctor's review in Birmingham, which. I also got a claim for the VA, and so periodically I would see the VA and get x-rays and so forth over the years, but that brings you back to home. I went on to Auburn and studied electrical engineering and majored in communications, and well, this is interesting. They had asked me to lay out the summer of 1949 as, they didn't use the term intern, but in essence that's what it was, to work for them. To see if we liked each other. Well, there was a recession, and they couldn't hire me, but they sold me. He says, you keep your grades like they are now, and you've got a job. I said, okay. So, anyway, I went on and finished, and I saw a guy over in Atlanta. He said, when should you go to work? I said, Monday. This was like on a Friday. So I went to work, graduated on Friday, went over to Atlanta, came back to Birmingham, and went to work on Monday. Worked 35 years, and I moved up from steward engineer to engineering manager, retired on the staff. But a lot of things happened. Four children born, now seven grandchildren, and one great-grandchild.
Wow. So you ended up having a good family.
Yeah, and we all just had a great time this weekend because Emma and I celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary.
Oh, gosh, congratulations. That's wonderful.
Thank you. Well, the kids arranged to have our marriage blessed, and I didn't know it, but Father Kelly, who's our pastor, we had this in the chapel. We had about 50-something people there, And we went through a renewal of our vows, which was interesting.
Oh.
Yeah.
How nice.
I don't know. They booked this luncheon in a very nice place, and we had I had a proclamation from the state senate, a proclamation from the mayor. I was pretty active in this little town of Hoover, which is 75,000. In fact, we have a room named after us up at the senior center, and I have a room named after me in Auburn.
Oh, how nice!
Yep. So once a year, Auburn gives me an opportunity to sit in the engineer's suite. So my son, who lives in Maryland, Al Jr., he's a retired Navy commander, flies down and takes me to Auburn, and we go up there to have food and drink. And he's a graduate of Georgia Tech. He went to Tech on a Naval ROTC scholarship, and he served 4 years and 16 years in the reserves, and he's retired. Well, he loves those trips, and they all love old Al, so that's how it goes now. Answer some questions.
Well, you did a fantastic job answering a lot of my questions. Do you have a few minutes for me to ask a few more?
Sure, I got plenty of time.
Okay, let me see. Were you able to keep in touch with your family at all while you were in the service?